and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of, well, medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and, well, whatever else is coming along. I hope that you will stay with me. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let's take a deep breath and launch right in. I had some very interesting science news that I wanted to talk with you about. Two articles, actually. So a big study came out this month, or actually November. I'm sorry, it was in November. I just came across it. And for those of you who are interested in research or who occasionally read science papers, those who are at that level, this is an example of a really well done study. It was a large cross-sectional study looking at vitamin D levels and depression scores. They did a regression analysis and found some very interesting things about vitamin D and depression. Essentially, to cut to the chase, if you have had a history of depression in your life, then a low vitamin D level is a very good predictor of depression. And in fact, if you keep the vitamin D level above about 33, the chances of having a recurrent depression are about the same as those who've never had depression. In other words, fairly low. And that's about as good as it gets. It would appear that people who have depression are more likely to suffer from depression again if they have low levels of vitamin D. This study was done in the southern United States, so it didn't show the strong seasonal variation that we see when you get above latitude 37 or so, but it was an extremely important study and a really well done one. Vitamin D has been implicated in inflammation, and one of the newest theories of depression is that it's related to inflammation. There are also strong associations now between low vitamin D levels and multiple sclerosis, and also the development of Parkinson's disease. Turns out the area of the brain, the substantia nigra, where Parkinson's disease gets started, has very high levels of both vitamin D receptors and the vitamin D activating enzyme called 1-alpha hydroxylase. So if you've got a lot of receptors and you've got a lot of enzymes for activating it, this makes the argument that it's extremely important in the function of that tissue. I've been doing vitamin D levels in my patients for about 5 years now, since I attended a functional medicine conference where Dr. Michael Hollick spoke. And I have seen very low vitamin D levels collectively in this area of the United States. And we're a community, a beach town. We have surfers. You wouldn't expect to find low vitamin D levels in surfers, but indeed you do, as well as people who exercise outdoors and are otherwise physically active. I think it has to do with sunscreen, but whatever it has to do with, vitamin D levels are very important, and they recently revised them upwards so that to be sufficient in vitamin D, then you're looking at being above 33. Half the time you may not be, even though you feel perfectly healthy, even if you're taking a calcium supplement with 400 units of vitamin D. So do get checked. This study is, again, not looking at treatment. So I still can't prove to you that putting a person on vitamin D is going to fix their depression, nor am I prepared to say that myself. But it definitely is a correlation between developing depression, so maybe it's a preventative. Either way, I think it makes sense for us to all get our vitamin D levels to at least about 35. And that's what I'm recommending. Get your blood level checked. Okay, and I had an off-air comment from Hal who wanted to know whether this study had controlled for latitude. And all of the people in this study attended the same clinic. It was the Cooper Clinic. It was a study running from 2006 to 2010. And they looked at 12,000 participants. So it was a very big local study. And presumptively, everyone was a patient locally at the Cooper Clinic, which is located in the southeast. So I think they did a decent job. It is described in the article as being located in the south of the United States. So that's, but I didn't look up their location. However, it seems to me that there wouldn't be a confound in terms of where people live. There is a very strong association between the latitude that you live in and your vitamin D level. So that was a good, insightful question. Thank you, Hal. The next story is about therapeutic hypothermia for brain ischemia. Brain ischemia means stroke, and in the last few years, we've been experimenting with cooling people down rapidly. It's been used for heart attacks, and in those circumstances, a person comes in with a cardiac arrest, or you have a neonate with a lot of low oxygen because maybe their lungs haven't fully developed. And both of these groups are at extreme risk, someone in cardiac arrest or a newborn who can't breathe, extreme risk for brain damage. And so risk-benefit, again, doing something also pretty dangerous, cooling their body down, has been tried successfully. Stroke is a somewhat different circumstance. Generally, in a stroke, these occur out in the community, and so there's a delay between the time that the stroke occurs and the time that any cooling can occur. Much of the research has been done in animals, and of course that's an experimental stroke and doesn't completely mimic the effects of natural stroke. But therapeutic hypothermia has now become a fairly consistent way of treating stroke at centers, and they are seeing evidence of better recovery. This review article, which I'll be posting a reference to, occurred in the journal Stroke, and it was supplement volume number 41, and that's December 15th, 2011. In experimental stroke, what it's looking like is that you don't really have to get people too cool. Let's talk about how this works. A person has a stroke. They develop a sudden paralysis. A CT scan is done to make sure they're not bleeding because there would be a contraindication in the case of hemorrhagic stroke. They're not bleeding. So a catheter is inserted into a large vein in the leg, and it's cooled, and as the blood runs through that vein, the temperature drops. We're dropping people, not so much, we're dropping people down to a brain temperature of about 35 or 34 degrees centigrade. Now that's down, well, basically about 10 degrees Fahrenheit from normal. So not so much. And it turns out if going lower doesn't make a difference. So you can protect the brain, and this neuroprotection with stroke is very effective. If you cool for more than 24 hours, it's been shown that you can really reverse the sorts of damage that you would expect to see. So what this tells us is that in the case of a stroke, a lot of the damage which is going on occurs ongoing because of the neurologic, well, the metabolic demand of those body temperature nerve cells. If we can drop them down to less than body temperature, they sort of go into hibernation. Their metabolic demand drops, and it's been effective even as much as 48 hours after the onset of stroke in some of the studies that were done. One of the side effects of doing this is the fact that you can get pneumonia, and that is the most common side effect of any people who have received hypothermia for either heart cardiac arrest or stroke. And it is much more frequent in cooled patients. However, if you have to choose between permanent brain damage and a case of pneumonia, I don't know about you, but I would know which one I would want to take. Now, there is also a drawback here in that when people have a stroke, you can sometimes give them enzymes that will break down the clot. And those enzymes definitely don't work as well when you've cooled down the body temperature. So it's going to be a little tricky for us to figure out the optimum way of doing it. Maybe giving the enzymes, waiting a couple of hours, and then starting the cooling so that we get the maximum clot lysis and then the maximum cooling. We'll still have a lot of work to do figuring out exactly how to do this, but it would not surprise me even slightly that in 5 years or so, standard of medical care will be to institute rapid body cooling when someone rolls into the emergency room with a history of stroke, particularly if it's been within the last couple of days. Imagine that, a couple of days and you can still make a difference. I find this very exciting. We're going to go to our first caller now. That is Robert in SoCal. Hello, Robert. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I was asked a question by an orthopedic surgeon very recently, and I didn't I didn't answer it because I must have had more than one moment, because it involved I was in for getting a consult for full knee replacement. So I was probably half in shock anyway. But the question was, do you feel any pain in your groin? And oddly enough, I had some mysterious, very, very brief pains. And I couldn't attribute it to lifting or anything like that. So I'd like to ask you, what is the relationship between...
Why did he ask that?
A brief pain in the groin area and serious arthritis in either or both.
Well, in response to your question, the reason that he asked about groin pain is because of the possibility that you also have hip arthritis. Sometimes pain from the hip will radiate or refer to the knee. So we have to be really careful, and it's sort of a knee-jerk thing, more commonly actually in young men with something called a slipped capital femoral epiphysis. Typically you see this in growing boys, sometimes a little bit overweight growing boys. They tend to be bigger and grow a little faster when they're in their early teens. They'll come in with knee pain, but actually what's happened is that their hip has gone out of alignment because the growth plate has shifted. And if you don't figure that out, it's very bad because you're busy focusing on the knee and you miss something important that needs to be fixed in the hip. So we all get trained to ask about groin pain whenever there's knee pain. So it's kind of, before I give an antibiotic, I asked
her to prize the doctor that, yeah, I've had, just a couple little twinges.
I don't think that sounds like arthritis. Your little twinges are probably, you might have a hernia and you should be checked for that, because that can give groin pain as well, and it's fairly common.
Well, that's what I was thinking, but it was so brief.
Yes, but you're going to be turning your head and coughing in the near future, I predict.
Well, no, I will definitely next time I see the primary doctor.
Yeah.
May I ask one more question?
Of course.
Thank you. What would be your quintessential salient admonition for someone who is going to get full knee replacement? What's the top thing, or concern that you would want to tell a patient?
Okay, first top of the thing right out of the box is quit smoking, if you smoke. It is hugely influential on how well you heal.
Right.
So that's number one. If you're a non-smoker, for the 3 or 4 weeks leading up to your surgery, eat a high protein diet and supplement calcium so that you go in there with lots of calcium, and be sure your vitamin D levels, pinging on something I said earlier that this program, make sure that your vitamin D levels are at least 35 so that you absorb the calcium that you're taking.
Okay, I'm doing that.
And, don't go above 1,500 milligrams, and don't go crazy with the calcium. You'll give yourself a kidney stone. But
So in the calcium realm, and when I'm perusing the shelves, the vitamin supplement shelves, I see calcite and whatever, but I really don't see calcium per se. It's always something that's combined with something else.
Right, because calcium is a mineral, and it has a charge, and you need to combine it with something with the opposite charge to form what's called a salt. So calcium is calcium citrate, or calcium gluconate, or calcium glycinate or carbonate, which is the one, of course, that we think about for Tums or antacids. And whatever salt of calcium you take, as soon as it gets into the stomach, it dissociates and you have free ionic calcium, which then requires the presence of vitamin D to be absorbed across the intestinal wall, where it's highly regulated. Once it gets into the bloodstream and the system, it's highly regulated by the kidney and the parathyroid gland.
Okay. And thank you for that.
Yeah. Blood levels of calcium have no reflection of whether or not you have enough calcium in your system, by the way, because your kidneys and your parathyroids will steal calcium from your bones until your bones are powder in order to maintain a normal calcium level in the blood.
Gotcha.
Because you need that for all of your nerves to work properly.
Oh, wonderful.
All right. Well, good luck to you,
well,
and I hope your surgery...
Dr. Don, your erudition is absolutely amazing.
Well, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Thanks.
Bye-bye. And let's go to our next caller, and that is Amy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi there. I was listening earlier about your comments on the vitamin D levels, and I just was wondering if you could talk for a moment about some of the best ways. I know supplementation is one of the best ways to raise your vitamin D level, but I'm wondering, when you're doing that supplementation, if there's things, foods, time of day, fats, proteins, that to combine it with for the best absorption. And I will take my question off the air.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Vitamin D comes in two forms. Vitamin D3 is the one that I prefer that my patients take. It is the one that is identical to the one that your body makes. Vitamin D2 is closely related, but is a byproduct of the manufacturers of something. I forget what. So it's abundant, and that's when you see the vitamin D milk. It's the one that's used for most food supplementation, which is also, if you think of it, kind of an industrial process. Nothing wrong with it, but it may not be quite as useful as vitamin D3. That's controversial and not a proven statement, so we'll kind of leave that out there in nebula land. But I go with it and use the vitamin D3. I try to get as close to bioidentical when I'm messing around with a hormone as I can. And vitamin D is really not a vitamin. It is actually a hormone that our bodies manufacture out of cholesterol, which is where most hormones come from. Our precursor vitamin D is made in the skin, and it requires transformation by both the liver and the kidney in order to be fully activated into the 1,25 hydroxy vitamin D. And that's what we eventually use to absorb calcium through the intestine. But the vitamin D levels also have lots of other things going on. There are vitamin D receptors, as I mentioned earlier, in large quantity in the brain. That's rather intriguing. There are vitamin D receptors in most of your body tissues, and particularly cardiac and bloodstream, like the bone marrow precursor tissues. It's very important in modulating the immune system. And while it also influences the absorption of calcium, it prevents the intestines from being leaky. It actually closes the tight junctions between the enterocytes, which are the lining cells of the intestine. So it has a lot of different properties. It's a fat-soluble vitamin. So people who are taking orlistat, which is a diet drug that prevents you from absorbing fat, people who are taking bile acid sequestrants, people who are often people who will develop vitamin D deficiency. It can also be seen in celiac disease or any other condition where the intestinal wall of the small intestine is impaired. All of these things influence absorption. I'm not aware of any studies suggesting that you need to take your vitamin D with a meal or, you know, with a fatty meal or anything like that. Although I guess theoretically that could improve absorption or interfere with absorption through competition. So I don't have any specific advice for you regarding combinations of nutrients with vitamin D or foods with vitamin D. So I hope that clarified it for you. I do use blood levels, and I do recommend the use of blood levels to all physicians, because I've been quite surprised at how low the blood levels are. Surprisingly low in people who look like they've got a tan and are athletic and would not be people I expect to have a problem. So clearly there are issues here that need to be addressed. And I'm sure that future research will bring us more information. At this point, we're going to go to our next caller, who is Phil in Gilroy. Hello, Phil, and welcome to the program.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
Doctor, I had a question regarding aspirin, plain old common Bayer aspirin. Supposed to be, they recommend it a lot of doctors do and have for years here, about for heart. Lately, I thought maybe I had a little heart condition. I'm not sure what I've got, you know, whether it's all mental or just, but I've been popping a few here and there. And just around that same amount of time, maybe the last 3-4 months or so, and I heard something about bleeding of the brain. They said they always warn you there, it can cause stomach bleeding. And there's some warnings out there now, and I've heard it 3 times. Just heard one the other day on the news. They were warning about it, and I saw another doctor, and I heard somebody else on a radio station somewhere else that it can actually, it's supposed to be good for your heart, but yet it can actually cause a stroke or help a brain bleeding,
mm-hmm.
and that it's kind of a bad thing. It's, I don't know, what might you know about that, and what also might you know about blood pressure? How would and taking this stuff a little bit here and there because I fell down and messed up my ribs. I was doing it for some pain. And in within a month's time, I always check my blood pressure. Maybe I know you don't recommend it at these CVS and all because they got their little machines.
Mm-hmm.
But out of three of them that I've been doing, and I do it frequently in three different places because I will do a lot of walking. I go across town, blah, 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 blah. My blood pressure dropped. And almost to, I don't say it's critical, but it's from, you know, the 120 over 80 or whatever the heck is supposed to be, you know, below. It's way down. And I don't know if it's good or bad or whether that's just, that could be just total coincidental. But
it could
that
be.
And the brain bleeding and
right.
And how much should a person take if this is all a bunch of, you know, hogwash or the other, the blood pressure and the brain bleeding, how much should a person take for their heart if they feel they have a heart condition or, well,
okay, I got it. All right, okay. So let's start with the heart condition piece. Let me just say that you sound like you're over 50, just based on your voice. And a man over 50, in my experience, who thinks he might have a heart thing, is often right. And you should get this investigated, okay? This is not something where taking an aspirin pill every now and then is going to fix the problem. So you need to see a doctor, you need to get an EKG, probably a stress test, and really investigate this. And that's kind of, that'd be kind of a minimum thing. Sniff around and tell somebody about your symptoms and get it checked out. Now, that's advice to you, has nothing to do with your question. Yeah, you need
that checked out good, though.
Yeah, I'd still get a,
we'll say that.
I'd still get a stress.
About a year ago, that
yeah, but
right on the money.
But now you're having symptoms that you weren't having a year ago, right?
What's that, dear?
I said, now you're having symptoms you weren't having a year ago.
No, it's all the same. It's just, I don't know if it's all in my head. I'm kind of a real stress person.
All right.
Get a stress test.
Get a treadmill test. And when you're running and working hard, if your heart does not show any signs of poor blood flow, then we'll drop it there. But I think you should have a stress test.
Would I notice that, doctor, in my own exercise? I just got through just today.
No, you wouldn't. It would be silent. It would be could be silent. But we pick it up electrically, so it's probably worth.
I wouldn't feel it in my exercising.
Well, if you did, that would be scary. But you could very likely not feel it and still have a problem.
Okay.
Okay, so that should be checked. But that's just out of the box. Now, aspirin, big epidemiological studies looking at lots and lots of people, and what they would say is, and this is based on, among other things, the Physician's Health Study. You know, there's 50,000 doctors enrolled in this study. The ones that are taking an aspirin report it, and the ones that are taking a baby aspirin report it, and then they just count heart attacks going forward to see if there's a difference. And basically, if you're taking the minimum dose, which is 81 milligrams of aspirin, that's a baby aspirin. So if you're taking a baby aspirin a day, you have a reduction in myocardial infarction, so a reduction in heart attacks. And that makes sense because a heart attack happens when a piece of plaque, which is a kind of a cholesterol deposit in the artery wall that makes it stiff. And when that stiffness is too stiff and it cracks open, that allows collagen and fat to be in contact with direct contact with the blood. And there's little cells in the blood called platelets whose job is to stop bleeding. And as soon as there's collagen or anything that shouldn't be there, exposed to the blood, those platelets jump on that like a football pileup and just try to block off the bleeding. And that's a very good thing. What aspirin does is it slows that down. So instead of jumping on at 50 miles per hour, they jump on at 20 miles per hour. So in the case of a clot you don't want, which is one blocking a major artery in your heart, I always like to use the analogy of when you were a kid and you were building a dam in a mountain stream. The water would keep running and you'd keep dumping mud. And finally, if you could finally get the water to stop, then you could relax. But as soon as the little bit of water started trickling over the top of your dam, it would melt through your dirt dam really quickly. And that's kind of the process that's going on in the artery. The blood wants to flow. If you can block it totally, then you get a propagation of that clot, and that's called a heart attack. If you can't block it totally and the blood is still flowing across the dam because the platelets are too slow to get that plug fully formed, then you have a chance of not getting a heart attack and just having chest pain and going to the hospital and getting either a balloon or getting a clot buster drug and having the whole thing reversed without sustaining any damage to the heart muscle. So, you know, when you play that out over 50,000 doctors, what they found was that Yeah, an aspirin reduces the risk. So
what about the milligrams, Doctor?
81 milligrams is the dose. There wasn't any improvement when you went to 325, which is a standard aspirin tablet.
Is there any disadvantage to doing this?
Sure, and that's where we get into the problem of if a person has a stroke. We're talking about the kind of stroke where a blood vessel breaks open. Okay, that's called a hemorrhagic stroke. If those platelets are working really well, they'll stop the bleeding and you'll have less bleeding into the brain, so you'll have less damage. If the platelets are slowed down because you're taking an aspirin, then the more aspirin you're taking, the more slow the platelets are, so the more bleeding. And that's why there's an increased risk of hemorrhagic stroke in people who have high-dose aspirin or who have platelet problems for some other reason, for that matter. But if you're taking even 325 a day, you've slowed down your platelets significantly. And so the risk of GI bleeding goes up, and that's a little worried about that in you, because while you were taking all that aspirin for your ribs, you may have actually lost blood, and that may be why your blood pressure is low. So there could be something going on there. I wanted to ask you, have you noticed that your poop has looked really dark? I don't know, many people don't look at their poop, but I do. If you're one that does.
Usually it's green because they eat a lot of broccoli rabe.
Right, but it hasn't been like dark or black or sticky or anything, has it?
No, I haven't noticed that, and I do check for that. And I don't notice any bleeding, any blood, or anything out of the ordinary.
Good.
Yeah,
generally aspirin has a neutral or raises blood pressure. If you're taking a lot of it, it can cause some fluid retention. And you can have a raise in blood pressure. So the thing when you say, okay, aspirin and low blood pressure, I'm worried about bleeding. And it sounds like you don't have indicator symptoms for that. But when you go to see your primary doctor to talk about that treadmill, you also might have him check you for anemia. You know, there's a lot of things that can cause a lowering of the blood pressure. And it sounds like you have a healthy diet. So what did you say it was getting down to? 90 over 60?
Well, and I usually read. See, I have a little weakness here. I like my beer, okay? And I notice that when I go want to cut back on beer, and I think I'm overdoing it, cut back or really go on the wagon, the blood pressure always drops. So I always considered alcohol as a big factor.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, it usually stays maybe just a little bit over the 120 over 80. Okay, I mean, I'd be, 125, 130, mm-hmm. and it fluctuates, of course, all the time. It'll fluctuate right within a day in a matter of minutes. I know that. But when I see this happening over and over and over, even though I'm using those machines, which are not that accurate, but when I go through three of them in three different places and they're all reading, I was getting like a 113 over 63 and, mm-hmm. 115 and 110 over, just lower numbers.
Okay. Yeah, they're not critical. Those are okay numbers. I think this is kind of a red herring. Anyway, to cut to the chase, everything that they are saying about the hemorrhagic stroke is true. So you have to balance your risk and benefit. And at this point, unless a person has risk factor for a stroke, like they know they have an aneurysm or there's a strong family history of hemorrhagic stroke, I still think that the risk benefit is definitely in favor of at least the baby aspirin. And in people who have had a TIA, which is a precursor to a dry or ischemic stroke, a full aspirin a day has been recommended for that group because the 81 isn't enough to drop the risk of TIAs, but the 325 is.
Okay, now the TIA, Dr., that's those mini strokes?
That's the mini strokes, yeah,
How do they work? What are the symptoms?
Well, the symptoms of a TIA are you suddenly lose the use of something, like your speech starts to slur, your face starts to droop, your hand gets weak and you can't move it. Those sorts of what we call focal neurologic signs. And the hallmark of a transient ischemic attack or TIA is that it's temporary and often gone by the time you actually get to the emergency room. And we don't see any signs of damage to the brain when we do a study like an MRI that'll pick up very subtle physiologic damage to the brain. In that case, in the TIA, you threw a blood clot, it blocked the blood vessel, but the stream got through that earth dam and started flowing again before any long-term damage was done. In the case of an actual stroke, the blood clot doesn't melt, and so that part of the brain that's downstream from the clot is deprived of oxygen. In like the early story we were talking about with the hypothermia, the ongoing physiologic need of the brain actually destroys those cells. And if we can shut them down and hibernate them while the clot takes care of itself, then we can prevent the damage. there's this big dynamic about how long does it take the clot to happen, how big a clot do you throw, what size blood vessel does it land in. There's multiple factors all feeding into this. So with something that's multiply factorial like that, you can't make a this is good, this is bad kind of statement. Now, we need to tie it up. Thank you very much for your call. We've covered a lot of important topics.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, those of you who are regular listeners to the show know that I wouldn't say I'm an anti-statin person, although I have been accused of that. I am anti-statin fever, thinking that this is something we should be putting in the water supply or that it's uniformly good. A recent study just came out. We've talked about the known side effects of statins, which include low risks, but still, you know, risks of hepatitis and muscle damage, and also the possibility, or at least which does seem to occur in some people, that statins are associated with fogginess of the brain. Many of these may be attributed to the drop in CoQ10 that happens when you take a statin. But this latest study, just published in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, are pretty significant in that they show an association between interstitial lung disease and statin use. Now, this is a retrospective study, so we have to be careful. It's not prospective. In other words, they found people who had the disease, interstitial lung disease, and this was by CT scanning and pulmonary function testing. And then they looked at covariables and discovered that the users of statins had a 60% increase in the odds of having interstitial lung disease compared to people who were not taking statins. There weren't any other positive associations between cardiovascular medications of any other kind or other disorders. There was no connection with having a history of high cholesterol or coronary artery disease and interstitial lung disease, but having statin use did associate with it. So this looks like something we need to investigate further. Also interesting was that it wasn't just all of the statins the same. The statins that had the highest hydrophilicity, that means the ones that were the most readily absorbed and dissolved in water, seem to have the strongest association between interstitial lung disease. We know that statins in experimental animals has been shown to aggravate fibrosis. And in mice, what they do is they give the mice bleomycin, which is a chemotherapy drug that causes inflammation of the lungs and is associated with lung fibrosis. In these mice, when they gave them statins before they gave them the bleomycin, they had more lung fibrosis develop. And the mechanism for this was activation in the macrophages of something called NLRP3 inflammasome. So the macrophages were more inflammatory, and macrophages actually are what release a little bit of digestive enzyme into the lung disease and that's what's responsible for interstitial lung disease. Often it's caused by fibers or particles, asbestos, coal dust, cotton lint fibers. These all cause lung diseases, typically called interstitial lung disease, where these foreign particles are engulfed by the macrophages, and in engulfing them, a little bit of belching of acid, like digestive acid, gets into that very vulnerable lung tissue, and over time causes it to scar up. A scarred lung can't expand. So the hallmarks of interstitial lung disease are inability to expand the lung, sort of like you had a straitjacket on or something constricting your lung flow. So people can't breathe faster, expand their lungs, and exercise, go upstairs, do things that would ordinarily require a little bit more oxygen. It's quite a disabling disease. And the association between statins and this disease needs to be looked at carefully. We're going to go to some calls now. The first is Peggy in Monterey. Hello, Peggy, and welcome to the program.
You mentioned that testing blood for calcium levels is not adequate, and I'm wondering, would you recommend saliva testing? I have a problem of leg cramps at night and thinking I'm low in magnesium.
I'm going to repeat your question, which was that you were wondering if saliva testing or some other form of testing could tell us about your calcium levels.
And magnesium.
And the answer is magnesium. It can be assessed through red blood cell or whole cell magnesium. Again, the kidneys regulate serum magnesium for reasons having to do with the nervous system and the heart, so you can't rely on serum levels, but the levels inside the red blood cells are decently good at reflecting your body stores. So red blood cell magnesium, and that's also true for things like zinc and copper, looking at the red blood cells themselves and what's inside that cell membrane gives you a better index for sufficiency nutritionally. And low magnesium definitely can be associated with leg cramps, so that would be a way to go. Unfortunately, intracellular calcium testing, again, doesn't really tell us about calcium sufficiency because of the way calcium is regulated by all of the cells. So a person could have low total calcium, in other words, not poorly mineralized bones, rickets, osteomalacia. They could be calcium deficient, but all of their blood levels would look okay.
Yes.
So we have to use indirect markers for that. And in the case of calcium, one of the things I like to look at is check the urine for bone reabsorption markers. So if a person is breaking down bone faster than they're building it, they'll have certain proteins present at high levels in their urine. And if they're recycling bone and building new bone at a normal rate so that they're in even balance of bone building and bone breakdown, then those levels of protein in the urine are lower.
Okay. I'm still not exactly sure, though, how you test for magnesium.
You get a red blood cell magnesium level.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Hope that was helpful. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going now to Raya in Santa Cruz.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. Yesterday I read an article online about vitamin D levels and the CRP markers.
Yes. Yes.
Can you comment on that?
Well, did the article suggest that the hsCRP, which is high sensitivity C-reactive protein, an inflammatory marker, tends to be higher in people who have low vitamin D?
It seemed to imply that up to a certain point, vitamin D levels should be kept up, and then too much vitamin D would have a negative effect, in other words, cause inflammation or
yes.
not.
Yeah. A typical,
and I wasn't able to understand the whole article. I didn't read it thoroughly enough, perhaps. But are you familiar with that?
Well, it's a phenomenon called hormesis, H-O-R-M-E-S-I-S. You could look that up in Wikipedia and get a good explanation for it. The hormesis is what happens with hormones. When I first learned this in medical school, it made absolutely no sense to me. And I learned it in the context of when women are having uterine hemorrhages. Sometimes women will have what's called dysfunctional uterine bleeding, and they'll start bleeding, and you have like the period that won't end, and they're hemorrhaging. And while this is a disease that is caused by too much unopposed estrogen, the treatment for it is massive doses of estrogen, or at least one of the treatments for it in an emergency situation is that you can give the person IV estrogen, and you give them so much estrogen that you block estrogen. It's a very weird effect that happens with most hormones. So you'll get the opposite of what you would expect. It's not logical. It's physiological. So that is, you know, vitamin D is a hormone. So we would expect that at very low levels, we would have X. And at very high levels, we would also have X, whatever X phenomenon that's undesirable is. And I have seen people who, you know, it's not simplistic. And there's lots of people out there, particularly in the alternative medicine world, who are kind of in the more is better mentality. I've had to pull people off of vitamin D and, you know, kind of take them to task for overdosing. And I think if your levels get above 100, there is a decent indication that you may start to have pro-inflammatory effects since, as I said, hormesis would predict that. And it's a hormone.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Makes total sense to me. I haven't seen that article, but like I said, I would have predicted it if you'd asked me. But I don't know what the threshold level for too much vitamin D is. Do you remember a number from your article?
I don't.
Well, if you can find it again.
4,000 a day.
I'll see if I can find it on a search. But if you can find that article again, just shoot me a link.
I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, to the AskDrDawn.com website. Just
send
me a link. Because I will put that out for everybody. I'm sure everyone would like to know what level they should stay below.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And get their blood tested.
Exactly.
I mean, how often? Once a year?
That's what I do. And I typically check people in the winter. A lot of patients, that's when you're at your lowest, obviously, because between October and March at this latitude, the strength of the ultraviolet that's getting to us isn't quite strong enough to generate much vitamin D, if any.
Right.
And of course, it depends on the time of day and the cloud cover and lots of other factors. It's been so beautiful lately, I think I might actually have been making a little vitamin D, but I haven't checked my blood levels to prove it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We're going to Johnny in Santa Cruz. Hello, Johnny. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Don, and thank you for taking my call, actually. I'm actually in transition right now, moving from Hawaii to Mexico. And prior to the move, I was lifting lots of heavy objects and packing things, this and that, and one of my legs swelled up. I am 69 years old, but, you know, I'm actually in great health. Anyway, after 2 weeks of this leg being swollen and flying here and going to Mexico and coming back, I finally went to Kaiser, and there's not a blood clot. They did the ultrasound, but they said I have a Baker's cyst, which is, you know, okay, but whatever that means, I can hardly walk. What has happened is I feel like it has strangled my sciatic or something right at my knee down to my feet.
Well, it probably is pressing on the nerve. And it is a ganglion. You know those Bible bumps that people get at their often at their wrists, little pouches. Have you ever seen one or heard of those ganglion cysts?
No, I haven't.
If you imagine that the joint is essentially two bones with some cartilage in between where the bones touch each other, and the whole thing is surrounded by a bag called the joint capsule, and the inside of that joint capsule makes a fluid, a lubricating fluid of hyaluronic acid called synovial fluid. And this lubricates the joint and acts as a shock absorber. And that's kind of your basic joint design. Well, if the wall of the joint capsule gets weak, it can form effectively a kind of aneurysm. It's not an aneurysm because it's not a blood vessel, but it's like an aneurysm. It's a loose spot and a bulge. And that bulge is still full of synovial fluid. And it can get looser and bigger, and there's a lot of space in the back of the knee, and it's a big joint, carries a lot of weight. So people will develop large ganglion cysts in the back of their knee, which can be painful, and they can push on things, and they can interfere with the lymphatic drainage, so you'll get relatively bigger swelling at the ankle or on the tibia on that side. They can also rupture and be very painful if they do break and fool people into thinking that you've got an acute thrombophlebitis or an infected blood vessel at that area. So usually...
What do I do? That's the
surgical...
I mean, you just said it takes time.
Yeah, surgical removal. I mean, realistically, if it's bothering you that much, you probably want to have it removed. I think you'd probably want to get an orthopedic appointment, get your primary doctor to...
I do have an orthopedic appointment.
That's what you want. They will remove it for you if it's continuing to be bothersome. You have a right to demand that.
Oh, I do.
Okay. You do.
Because they kind of just said, well, you know, this could take 6 to 8 months. Well, I can't function like this.
Then you can have surgery.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I usually refer people for surgery for this. This isn't something I treat conservatively.
Right.
You may also have some arthritis that you flared up with all of the squatting and lifting that you did, which could be contributing to it. That will fade over several months, but obviously just the Baker's cyst alone, if it's really impinging on the nerve and causing a lot of pain, you have a right to have that fixed.
Well, okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. On a normal basis, if I treated this on a conservative basis, would it be just rest? That's going to, you know, and ice and heat treatments that would
generally
take the inflammation out?
Yes. Well, anti-inflammatories, compression, like an ACE bandage or some kind of brace to kind of push push on things can be helpful. And let me see. Generally with these, I send them to my surgical colleagues for excision if they're symptomatic at the level that you're having. I don't usually treat them conservatively.
Right. Could they aspirate out the liquid?
Yes, but it'll just come back. It's continuous with the joints capsule, so it'll just come back.
I don't ever want this again, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I do appreciate your information on it. Thank you so much. You're a great service to the community.
You're very welcome, and thanks for the compliment.
Bye-bye.
Let's see. We had a off-air question about if there are any alternatives for statins. So let me take a moment and say, indeed, yes, there are. First of all, unless you have a hereditary abnormality that causes you to have really excessively high cholesterol due to a mutation, most of us just need to change our diet a lot. Fruits and vegetables, lots of lean protein, forget the cheese, forget the high-fat animal products, and drop your starch. And for many people, that will have a very positive effect on their lipids. Exercise, hugely important, getting down to an appropriate body weight, because essentially bad cholesterol is a storage form for excess calories. So stop having excess calories. Exercise is extremely helpful. And it depends on what type of cholesterol is high. In people who have a low HDL cholesterol, the use of niacin is a very good way to lower cholesterol. There are also cholesterol agents that just sit in the bowel. They're called bile acid sequestrants, and they lower cholesterol. But I want to caution that lowering cholesterol by these other agents, such as bile acid sequestrants, Zetia, which is another drug that interferes with the reabsorption of cholesterol in the intestine, while these improve cholesterol scores, they've never been shown to reduce cardiac events. And statins have been shown to reduce cardiac events. So that's important. It's also important to note that you have to treat 50 high-risk people to prevent one cardiac event, and that the primary effect of the statin is probably anti-inflammatory. That being said, I would point out that there's an excellent study looking at high-dose fish oil, and we're talking about an EPA and a DHA level that got up to about 2,000 milligrams a day. And there is evidence that that worked as well as Lipitor in preventing events. It's only one study, because as you can imagine, getting funding for that study was difficult, but it was a persuasive study, head-to-head, enough fish oil and Lipitor, same event reduction. So another nail in the coffin that it's really anti-inflammatory benefit that we're getting from the statins, and that the change in cholesterol score may not even be the most important aspect of what we're doing with that drug. Law of unintended consequences is at work big time here. We've got time for just one quick story, and I think I'll throw out this one. Bipolar disorder runs in families, but studies looking for genes to identify the causes of bipolar disorder have not been very successful. There have been several things that looked positive and then they didn't replicate. A lot of gene clusters tend to be related to the ethnicity of a population and have nothing to do with the disease. So if you get something in India, you have to replicate it in the United States before it's really believable. We currently look for DNA. I mean, the way we do this research of looking for genes that link to traits is we use a process to amplify the DNA. And this amplification process may, in fact, be creating a huge blind spot for us. Now, this study came out of UC San Diego School of Medicine, and it was published in the December 22 issue of Neuron. They were looking at bipolar disorder, and what they found was that it's not the particular gene, but how many copies of that gene that you have. This is called a copy number variant. I'm going to call it CNV rather than say copy number variant a bunch of times. And CNVs are where you have either too few or too many copies of a section of DNA. And researchers have known that this happens for a lot of diseases. For example, it's been linked to schizophrenia. It's been linked to autism, where the parents don't have the normal number of copies, but something goes wrong in development and the offspring have too many copies of a single piece of DNA. And if you have too many copies of it, you're likely to transcribe too much of it and make too much of a protein and throw off a balance somewhere. And that's apparently what's going on in many cases of bipolar disorder, particularly those that occur early in childhood or teens. And looking at this, the researchers found that there is a high number of copies of certain normal genes in people who develop early bipolar disease. This suggests that what may be inherited in the family is actually a tendency to make too many copies, or a tendency not to restrict the development of multiple copies during gene replication. It just keeps getting more and more complicated. I'm glad that we decoded the human genome, but it's given us many more questions than answers. We've come to the end of another hour, and I certainly hope that you've enjoyed it as much as I. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.